Why does a company that rents office space need a side business making artificial waves? Yes, this week on Download This Show, inside the rise and the fall of WeWork. Plus, Netflix famously don't give out viewer numbers, but suddenly with the rise of Apple and Disney and all the other big new streaming services, are they about to change their tune? All of that and much more coming up. This is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. My name is Mark Fennell and welcome to Download This Show. Yes, indeed. It is a brand new episode of Download This Show. We are joined in studio, but it's been far too long, Benjamin Grubb.
So long. Glad to be back. Hello.
Am I saying you're from the Sydney Morning Herald? Am I saying you're from Fairfax? Am I saying you're from Nine?
From the Nine.
Oh,
from the
Nine. He's got a little keep cup, which makes you, by the way, fundamentally like more pure than me, because I keep losing keep cups and buying new ones. And it turns
out...
You
need like five of them too.
Yeah, once you have like four keep cups, it ceases to be environmental. It just starts to be litter. Alongside Ben Grubb, we have from the CBS universe. But like now we have to announce everybody's overlords.
Yeah, we're technically... it's an expanded universe.
Yeah,
you know.
But you actually work for CNET,
the technology website. Right.
Claire Riley, welcome back to Download This Show.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Now that we've worked through everyone's corporate allegiances, I'm Mark Fennell. I work for the ABC, SBS, occasionally also Amazon, I suppose, as well. And we're going to start off by talking about a disastrous situation that's happened. Actually, it's been remiss of me that we haven't covered this yet, because it has been this unfolding story in the US. If you're not familiar with WeWork, I might get you to explain what WeWork, what the sell was, before we can explain exactly what went horribly, horribly wrong, Claire.
So the sell of WeWork is, I guess, a pretty cool concept, not necessarily totally new or unique, but essentially a co-working space. So maybe you're a young creative, maybe you're starting a startup, but you don't have enough room or money for your own office. So you would buy into a WeWork co-working space. You might get a desk, you might get your own office. You pay a monthly kind of rental to them, and they design them as kind of cool hipstery places with lots of like minds together. They talked about how in one of their WeWork offices they had a whole bunch of music people. So it was like, maybe you want to network with those people.
I believe they call it jamming in
the music business. Yes, they do. No one calls
it that. I don't know that. Yeah,
yeah, so it was a company that started with a lot of fanfare in about 2010, and they grew and grew and grew, and lo and behold, they exploded in spectacular fashion.
And that was only after they filed for a public offer. So they were going to go on the stock market.
Yeah.
And that's when they had to divulge all of their accounts. And with that comes intense scrutiny. And that's when things started to unravel.
So what did they... So when they put out all... They opened up their accounts as part of their initial public offering. What was it that was discovered? Like, what did they realise was going awry?
Well, there were a lot of concerns with their path to profitability. And with their leader at the time, Adam Neumann. And so they ultimately delay their IPO to September 16 or so, right back then. And I think it's kind of just all fallen apart now.
Mm. I mean, it was one of those IPOs where they're like, we're an amazing business. We work in the kind of collegiate spirit of co-working spaces. And everyone was like, yeah, cool. Can you just go to page 3 of your S1 filing documents for this IPO and explain why Adam Neumann was taking loans from the WeWork company? Can you also explain why he was renting out his own buildings that he owned to WeWork? Can you also explain why when you change your name from WeWork to We...
No.
Yeah.
No.
They sure did,
Mark.
Do
none of these people have five-year-olds and realize how that can be handled?
Yes, yes, poorly. When they changed their name, they had to pay Adam Neumann for the intellectual property of the word we, and they paid him some $5.6 million, or was that the amount of the loan he took out? Anyway, it was a whole bunch of just really basic like corporate governance stuff that everyone was like, this doesn't really add up. And then you throw in the fact that Adam Neumann was just Silicon Valley grade bonkers, walking around with no shoes on.
The broest of bros.
The broiest of all of the tech
like
bros.
Broier than the guy that used to run Uber that everybody hates.
We're
talking like reports of him smoking weed on a private jet, serving employees tequila shots after discussing layoffs.
Oh my gosh, that was the best part of it.
Trademarking the term we and then forcing WeWork to buy it for $5.9 million, as you mentioned. And then eventually he did have to step down, and I think he got reportedly something like $1.7 billion in severance.
Yeah, ooh, that's a golden parachute and a half.
Okay, so here's the thing that I find confusing about WeWork and the story of how it's all gone awry, right? In the grand tradition of startups, WeWork actually made sense to me. Like, as in, there are all of these different startup apps that, you know, they generate, they accrue an enormous amount of capital because somebody's willing to chuck money at them on the off chance they turn into the next Facebook. But also, but ultimately, it doesn't take an enormous amount of mental energy to look at these certain apps and go, how do you ever make money? Not how do you make money now, but how do you ever make money in the future? There's a lot of sort of apps that deal in the ephemeral. But WeWork, they buy buildings, they rent out space in buildings. I don't know. Like, that doesn't feel like a particularly groundbreaking or particularly risky venture.
But listen to what you just said, right? You said they buy buildings, they rent out buildings. Well, they're a real estate company. They're not a tech company. And I read a great article about WeWork saying, is the idea that if you just say tech enough around your business, then VC funding will come in and be like, you guys are a startup, you're a tech company, this is amazing. It's like, no, no, no. They're landlords, effectively. It's a very modern and kind of sharing economy way of thinking about it. But it was a simple enough concept, and yet they didn't make money. Last year, they made $1.8 billion in revenue in 2018, and then they had $1.6 billion in costs. So at the start of this year, like, those numbers just don't add up, right? The start of this year, they said their valuation pre-IPO was about $49 billion. It's not. They massively downgraded that overall, like, after all these kind of scandals. And they're actually now valued at something like 10 to 12 billion. And they've raised 12.8 billion in capital since they started. So they are literally just hemorrhaging money, and they're only valued as much as the money they've been bringing in.
Okay, so what is the issue then? Are they do they spend too much on property, or do they charge too little for the cool musicians?
I guess most investors would want profitability within their lifetime.
Crazy.
What a low bar we're aiming for here.
They're not investing in order to, you know, serve their future son or daughter, you know, the money that might come from that investment. And so, it was that basic path to profitability, which they don't seem to be worrying about. And a lot of companies, a lot of tech businesses don't seem to be worrying about profitability within now-ish, you know, maybe in the 5-10 year short-term, right, mid to short-term.
But you talk about these companies, right, and you mentioned Uber earlier. I think that's a really good example. They spend so much, and then they are just kind of chasing the next unicorn. They are unicorns themselves, companies that are valued at $1 billion pre-IPO. I think that's the idea of a unicorn.
No, it's a horse with a cone in front of it.
It's like the land
narwhal. Don't get confused.
Sorry.
If you had a three-year-old daughter, you know the difference.
Yeah, you know what a unicorn
is. And it's never been profitable.
No, right? It hasn't. And the thing with WeWork is they put their money into all these random side businesses. So a company that was designed to help people book conference rooms. So a lot of stuff that was adjacent to their core business model.
Yeah, I kind of
but
get
then
that.
Also a wave company, like making artificial waves in a wave pool. That doesn't seem to be core.
Depends. Can you rent it in small time increments?
I mean,
the business.
And the example of tequila shots. I mean, there was a case where Adam Newman came in and he said, all right, everybody, we need to cut 20% of our workforce. Immediately after having that conversation, he put the music up. One of the guys from Run DMC came into the room and did a performance while everyone did tequila shots. And all of these staff members were like, hold on, what was this about 1/5 of the workforce being cut? And he's like, don't worry about it, tequila. And you saw that in the early days of Uber as well, you know.
They got Beyonce in, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, right.
And gave her some stock and then told all the employees afterwards, and she's invested in us. And it turned out that that was her. Part of her payment for doing the performance to get the stock, and it was...
Yeah. These people have a very sound idea, but so much of it is influenced by this culture that kind of is allowed to fester and grow in Silicon Valley that is, you know, we move fast and break things. We are disrupting the world. We are a group of, you know, largely the same kinds of dudes who are all trying to solve problems that our mothers used to solve for us, dropping us to high school, gym practice, you know, letting us hire a room. Like, all of these problems seem like babysitting problems. Mm. And I think it's a great idea, but if you don't execute on that, you can have the best idea in the world, but if you're a really terrible business leader, you're going to drive it into the ground. And it, like, you just look at this and it's just mistake after mistake. And you're exactly right. It speaks to this broader, I think, cultural malaise that people didn't really understand Silicon Valley and they didn't really understand tech. And that's not sort of, I guess, a negative thing. It's sort of, there were all these startups promising the moon and they were hidden behind a wall of code and algorithms and stuff you don't really need to worry about. It's shiny. The app looks really great.
Trust me, I have a hoodie.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then suddenly that kind of, we peeked behind the curtain and it's just some dude with no shoes on just like pulling levers and trying to be the great and powerful Oz. And I think the world is starting to realize that it's all a sham.
It's very strange though that this is happening all over again since, like, there was the same thing in the dot-com era.
Yeah.
You know, except then it was like, oh, we've made a website. That's $1 million valuation right there. Mm. And I think I'm going to, like, coin it as, like, the Silicon bubble, much like the Canberra bubble, alleged Canberra bubble, is that they all talk to each other and it's like this echo chamber of, like, yeah, we're making the world a better place for the greater good, blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, like, the investors start asking questions. That's the difference now, I think, is that as these companies go public, the scrutiny kind of intensifies, and that's when they take their large valuations and try to cash out. Mm. It's at that point where we start to see what's behind the curtain.
Yeah, and I think in this case, we've probably also got a broader climate of people not wanting to just sign a blank check and give it to the tech company. You know,
they have been doing that.
Absolutely, yeah. Right? And so, but we're seeing increased regulation. We're seeing Zuckerberg and we're seeing, you know, the heads of the tech communities being hauled in front of Congress and having to answer questions. And there's talk about, you know, one of the biggest presidential candidates, Elizabeth Warren, wants to regulate the tech giants. So I think there's possibly more of a, oh, we're going to scrutinize. And that's when we saw WeWork fall apart. It was around the IPO and when they had to put the numbers down on paper, and it wasn't just about having their, you know, dude bro retreat where they slap each other on the back. It was numbers on a page.
It's a complicated challenge, the whole idea of regulating an industry that has proved, like, its potency, I guess, is in how fast it moves. Mm. And that is in part fueled by how willing people are, people with money, venture capitalists, people with enormous amounts of money, how willing they are to buy into hype, because that fuels the speed at which these companies grow. It'd be interesting to see what regulation actually looks like, and if you could hypothetically master regulation that provides like checks and balances but doesn't actually get in the way of the incredible growth that has come with it. And I guess this is where the nuance comes into it, because the reality is a lot of these services from a consumer standpoint, certainly I think of things like Uber in particular, they are amazing, or they certainly can be amazing. And Uber did solve a problem. Taxis were bad.
Yeah.
And WeWork does also solve a problem in the sense that, you know, not every startup can necessarily afford a full, you know, 1-year lease in a location where you want to bring a client to. So I think what would be interesting, and I'd love to know your thoughts on this, is how do you stop this from happening without getting in the way of the thing that makes the tech startup world exciting and interesting and problem solving?
I mean, one, I don't think they're really going to be regulated that much in the first place, because the regulators don't fully understand the beast they're trying to control. And we've seen these kinds of bubbles before. And, you know, without calling specific companies out, so many of these companies kind of operate like Ponzi schemes, right? You know, it's bring as much money in and we spend. And it's like, it doesn't have to match up now because we're chasing the next big fish. So, you know, I don't know that they're necessarily going to be regulated in a massive way. And if they are, you know, the big people at the top will get out with their golden parachutes, as Adam Neumann did. He got $1.7 billion to leave the company. And he's still being retained as a consultant for $46 million a year.
Well, he's good at a party. I mean,
oh my gosh, this guy. And if they are regulated, I think it's going to be slow. So companies will adapt around it.
I think that the way that, you know, we stop the kind of craziness that's going on now is by just, you know, simply having smarter investors, like, as in, you know, smarter amateur investors. Because I guess at the moment, what's happening is that, you know, the VCs lead the way before the kind of it hits the stock market, and then they're looking for their quick out after it gets put on the stock market. And if the valuation is good enough, they'll check in and get a third of it out or whatever. And then they're hoping that the stock gets boosted by the mum and dad investors. And it's at that point, when something, the hype, it's all about hype I think regular people who are investing in the stock market need to not buy into that hype and look at the documents that are put on and actually read them and get financial advice, because a lot of it is media coverage. I've worked in public relations before, and you know, an article is worth a lot of money, especially sometimes to stock market prices. So, and people do buy on the basis of that. So, I think that more education to people around what they're investing in would help pop that, you know, overvaluation of these startups.
I think it's the more things change, the more they'll stay the same. I don't see any massive changes. I think the venture capitalists will always be crazy with their speculation and the froth of the market. And it's just about the rest of us educating ourselves and kind of slowly waking up and going, hold on, tech isn't this great panacea. You know, startups aren't the biggest problem solvers. A lot of them are solving problems, but they're not going to be, you know, they're mere mortals. I think we're sort of realizing that.
Fewer companies that aren't just existing on slide decks would be good. And I think that, you know, I think journalists actually play a big part, and that's what happened in the dot-com boom, was that journalists started looking at the financials of these companies and started seeing their cash run rates were depleting. And often, if you look at the ASX, even in Australia, you'll see that companies are often raising money like every 3-6 months. You know, that's because they're running out of money. They just keep topping them up. So less topping up, give, you know, think, is this company going to be around much longer? Maybe if not, then maybe sell those shares. So, yeah, I think it's just all about education, really.
Yeah,
not being sucked in by the VCs who overhype these companies.
Yeah, you're right. If you took the slide deck away, if you took the very Apple-esque design away, if you took the app away, is it a new idea? Is it revolutionary? Or is it really the same sort of thing? I mean, I think about one of my favourite examples is Juicero.
I knew the Juicero would come up at some point.
Juicero, my favourite of things. It was basically a juicing machine that you like hooked a produce pack into, and it squeezed out the juice. And then Bloomberg did this great story that was like, hey, you ever tried just like cutting the bag open and scooping it out with your mitts and squeezing it with your hands? Turns out that was the same as this $300 Wi-Fi connected machine that had the pressing power of two Teslas, whatever the hell that is. It's literally
My cold pressed
drinks.
Oh
my gosh. It's literally my favorite Silicon Valley story. And I think about it every third day. And, you know, they were talking about the need for a QR code so in case there was a lettuce recall, we could recall the produce packs. And everyone says, you're overcomplicating something that doesn't need to be overcomplicated. And there was this moment of like, in this case, the journos kind of pulling it out and being like, guys, you can squeeze this with your hands. And everyone kind of just sort of shook the fairy dust off their noses and just sort of said, oh, yeah, this isn't revolutionary. Just because it's got a Bluetooth connection and a QR code reader doesn't mean I need to buy it, you know. Think a bit of that scrutiny and that kind of natural cynicism. I'm a very cynical person, so just kind of absorb a little bit of that hatred of everything and
download this show. Is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in media, technology and culture. And it is our weekly check-in with the streaming wars. Of course, last week we saw the release of Apple TV Plus. Very soon, Disney Plus will launch. And of course, there's the swathe of other things. Hey you. But I did want to jump back to, I guess, the grandpappy of the streaming wars, which is, of course, Netflix. Now, Netflix have responded to being under siege, let's go with that as an analogy, really interestingly. So one of the things they've actually started doing, which is something that Netflix have almost always never done, is they've started releasing viewer numbers. For a long time, it was quite famous, certainly within Hollywood, that even people that created TV shows for Netflix wouldn't know how many people were watching. But now, I guess in response to what's the pressure that they're under, and I guess the talent market, Ben, they're starting to come forward and talk about how many people are watching things.
Yeah, and I think that the reason for that is, again, Apple coming out, they know that they're going to have a big competition on their hands because Apple is quite large. Apple's pushing aggressively here, and this is one of the reasons why they are releasing these numbers, because Apple's doing a bundle deal now. When you get a new iPhone or a new Apple product, you get 12 months free subscription to the Apple TV service. And so Reed Hastings, is that
the CEO of of Netflix, yes.
Yeah. He's come out and said that, you know, the subscriber numbers, which is what's typically been promoted as or touted as to, you know, that's how success, doesn't mean anything when there's all these bundle deals going on with Amazon, Apple.
So the metric he's been using for many, many years yes, no longer snark. Applies because other companies...
It's inconvenient.
Yes.
It's like when you're playing tips in the playground, someone decides something's on bar and then, you know, someone can reach it really easily. It's like, well, no, okay, well, I'm changing the rules.
Yeah,
like,
the goalposts are being moved and...
That's the more conventional metaphor, yes.
Yes. Sorry, what was the licking of the something earlier?
Oh, look, who knows?
But what's interesting, though, even though I think it's slightly hypocritical for him to move the goalposts on a metric that he's been using for some time, he's come forward and he's put forward that actually the metric that we should be examining is time,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and not a metric that Netflix necessarily is putting out. He's promoting Nielsen, which does surveys usually, and much like radio ratings.
Mm, famously, they did the TV ratings for many, many years. Too.
Yeah, and I think now it's some sort of Oztam might do that in Australia. Mm. And often they do it based on like a sample of like 1,000 or 2,000, and then they extrapolate that to the Australian population because all of Australia is watching TV, of course.
Naturally. Mm.
And so that's what happens in TV land. And, you know, I think he says that Netflix consumes about, in at least the US, 10% of TV time, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah, he's saying, you know, start looking at Nielsen's ratings and he's looking to back that. But they could put out their own numbers if they wish.
Well, this is the thing, right? And I think, so the quote here is, so the real measurement will be time, how do consumers vote with their evenings and do they end up watching what mix of all the services? Honestly, I think he might be right. I think that's a fair thing. If we can get real and comparable numbers, which not everybody has an impetus to want to deliver, Claire.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think he's right that the idea of we have, especially as we enter the streaming wars and our time becomes more valuable and we're subscribing to a million different types of content, we only have one set of eyeballs for now. So
the night is young.
Yes. So what are we choosing to spend our evenings watching? And they have kind of before now released limited numbers, but I think...
When they've got a good story to tell.
Exactly.
You know,
so
like
Bird
35
Box,
million households watched The Stranger Things.
Precisely, yeah. Bird Box was sort of got up to 80 million. Sex Education, that kind of young adult skewed TV show, got, I think, 40 million in the first 4 weeks. And you think about big series in the US, traditionally 20 million is a really, really good number for audiences. So they have a good story to tell. They're really spruiking that. But of course, I guess it's like anything in a free market, right? As soon as you start to have really strong competition, then they're going to have to up their game. And Netflix is probably going to have to start saying, all right, well, to prove we're still valuable, yeah, we're going to give you a bit more information. It's not clear whether they're going to give the data to Nielsen themselves, whether Nielsen will still do its kind of slightly, well, not janky, but they don't necessarily get data from Netflix. Well, they haven't until now, so they've made estimations.
There has been a social media company that I think have made, I've forgotten their name, but they periodically do, I think, a survey of what people are talking about on social media. And from that, they extrapolate what things are watching. I look at it and just go, seems like, very imperfect.
It's like trying to get, like, you know, the idea of where do Australians politically lie, but just looking on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also the Oztam ratings required you to have a box plugged in, or, you know, maybe ratings required you to get called up on your landline. So that's naturally skewing towards an older audience, maybe not watching on mobile. I'm interested because Netflix knows who's watching what. They know how far they're watching through a program.
Yeah.
They know probably a lot about the demographics who's watching.
Because obviously they don't need to deal with advertisers, so that's why you wouldn't make it public. But I would also say that from a talent standpoint, it's also complicated, right? Because you don't know if you've got a successful series on one of these things unless you get a renewal, unless they're now starting to share more information. Last I heard that they won't.
I wonder if they will go down the advertising route. Like, numbers are useful, I guess, for, you know, determining how to model the pricing and whether to increase. And I think they might. I think they have been increasing it.
Yeah, gradually
in the US.
They sort of increase it here and there.
But, yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of interesting because, you know, in Australia, news publications have typically had page impressions as like as a key metric in like the 2010s perhaps and earlier. And then it moved, depending on the different publisher, to a subscriber model with a mix of advertising. And then the metric internally at some of these organisations became about time on article or time on site. And that became more important. But that hasn't, I don't think, translated to advertisers in that space yet. You can't go to an advertiser. You can try, but you can't go to an advertiser and say, oh, we've got higher engagement than a competitor. But that is definitely a push that's being made. And it is interesting how the advertisers are what end up driving the business models.
But interestingly, you think about YouTube, right? And watch time is everything on YouTube. Mm. So that's the engagement time there. So it's kind of different.
So as in watch time, as in how long they watch the video itself?
How long people are watching. So you think about Joe Rogan's podcasts, which go for 43 hours. he is popular with
that's
advertisers.
That's a short one too.
Oh, gosh. That's for another day. but, you know, there's a long engagement time. You've got to look at how long people are watching and when they drop off. So there's a whole bunch of metrics there. I think what's interesting is that they're changing the goalposts. A cynical person, which is me, would say that are they just changing the goalposts because they have 160 million subscribers worldwide and maybe those numbers are starting to plateau? Apple TV Plus and Disney are going to start to see some real growth because they're coming off a zero base, right? Mm. Netflix is really high, so it's not having a massive kind of rate of change. So to say we're commanding more eyeballs and more time, that's an easy metric for them to win on.
The thing I was saying before that I probably didn't communicate terribly well is I think from a creator's standpoint, the ability to reach that many households in one go. I was listening to an interview with, I think, Joel Edgerton, who was talking about making the film Boy Erased, which is a beautiful film. They set it out to, I think they put it out through Focus Features and cinemas in the US, and they had a lovely campaign, but in retrospect, I think he feels like if they'd put it on a surface like Netflix, they would have got a much bigger cultural impact, which I think, you know, when you're talking about attracting high-level talent, cultural impact, ability to reach people in houses, that kind of stuff matters, I think. And so that's where this, I think, gets slightly competitive. And I think creators that pour their love and soul into something probably do want to know how many people they're reaching.
Mm. Yeah, and maybe they don't want to have to think so much about an outdoor marketing campaign or, you know, getting their actors to go on the talk show circuit to spruik it because you've already got a captive audience with Netflix. Mm. You already have a captive audience around the world as well. So you mentioned the kind of more maybe niche or art house films, right? Netflix has really spruiked that they've got shows. I think it was The Bodyguard from the UK. They have, you know, Turkish shows that have been really popular in international audiences. So once again, they're trying to sell that measurement. But this is of course, them selling the different kind of slices of information and data that, I guess, advantageous for the story they're trying to promote.
I just think that they'll start having like a gold membership or something that's like the additional, like this plus more.
Like a tiered membership.
Yeah. Like, so why else would they be deciding to release ratings? I mean, like, yes, you'll get perhaps creators. If they start releasing numbers, there'll be creators out there like yourself, Mark, where you'll go, okay, yeah, now I want to be part of that because, you know, I can start to attract better talent because I'll be able to tell them that the audience that they're going to reach. And then, you know, that'll be good. But like, I think that it is more around perhaps advertising or inserting some ads in there. Maybe they'll have a free version of Netflix, but with ads, or maybe that might be the way to go. I'm not sure about the Spotify model.
In the end, all we know, money probably talks. And with that, I will leave you. Ben Grubb from the Massive 9/Fairfax Network. Thanks for coming back on Download This Show.
Thanks for having me.
Claire Riley from CNET, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed the show, make sure you leave a review, preferably positive, but you know, you do you. My name is Mark Fennell, and I'll catch you on the next episode of Download This Show.